food is ultimately the source of energy for humans. As animals, we don't photosynthesize to create our own food, so we have to rely on secondary sources for our energy and for the protein that we need in order to function and to build new cells. This is what keeps us alive. And our choices, our sources for food are varied. As humans technologically advance, we aren't dependent, as our ancestors were, on the local environment to determine our diet. We grow food in Minnesota and Arizona that is consumed in Russia and Africa and other parts of the world. And other parts of the world grow food for us to consume here. Our food choices have become more complicated because, as consumers, we now consider how our diet affects global climate change. What are the best meats, or, for that matter, should we even eat meat at all? How can our farmers and food producers protect their crops from weeds and pests while protecting the pollinators from poison? When the choices that we face aren't clear, there really is only one way to clear things up. To get some solid answers, societies need to turn towards science. Our guest on Iconocast for this episode is Emily Cassidy. Emily is a researcher for the Environmental Working Group, and her master's thesis project researched a new set of metrics to balance the cost of food production with the needs of protecting the environment. Welcome to Iconocast, the science and science advocacy podcast. I am Mike Hobrick, and along with Greg Layden, I invite you to listen to our 9th episode of Iconocast with our guest, Emily Cassidy.
Emily, your work, as I think many of our listeners probably know, has been in the area of agriculture and the effects of agriculture and the economics of agriculture. You're famous for having invented a metric for relating land use to food production and how many people can, you know, live off of a certain amount of agricultural endeavor. Can you give us, first of all, a big picture estimate of your current thinking about how much time we have on this planet before we have our next really serious major global food crisis?
Well, you know, I think there's a lot going on with agriculture right now. I think one of the biggest problems that we have with food production is that it's taking up a lot of land. It emits a lot of greenhouse gases. It's polluting our waterways. It's the main reason that over half of in the United States, for example, over half of our rivers, lakes, and bays are, you know, too polluted to fish in, swim in, certainly drink from. I think one of the things that I'd love to see going forward is a consideration of not just how much stuff are we producing on our farms, but also how are we treating the neighboring environments, the water that we depend on, the soil that's an essential part of food production, and the atmosphere, which essentially determines weather patterns in the future. So I think that we have a long way to go in terms of changing the way that we produce food, but I'm very hopeful that with policies and with consumer demand for a different kind of agriculture, not just organic, but agriculture that takes into consideration more things than just yields, that's not so chemically intensive. I think that it's all to do with convincing people that the food system that we have right now is broken and needs to radically change its ways. But we can get there with very, very simple fixes that actually don't cost us money and will probably save us money in the long term once you consider how much money we're spending on cleaning up after farming in this country and around the world. So I'm hopeful that we'll get there. It's just that we have an agricultural system that's basically, you know, we made agricultural support through the Farm Bill after the Great Depression in order to make sure that we still had farmers in the country, designed to save farmers from economic disaster. But now it's actually supporting types of farming that are often more polluting. And so it's incentivizing farmers to plow up sensitive land, and, you know, with crop insurance, they're allowed to go into places that they normally wouldn't, because they know that they're going to get a certain amount of income every year. And so I think changing these policies can really have a huge impact on the environment and our food system.
Has there been a major overhaul in regulation and subsidies for farms? Are we using a really antiquated and ancient system, and is anyone trying to undo that or fix that or modernize it?
At the Environmental Working Group, that's one of the major things that we work on, is to ensure that the Farm Bill gives farmers some securities but doesn't promote pollution, doesn't promote subsidies that have bad environmental consequences. But so far, a lot of the changes that have happened with the Farm Bill has had some unintended effects. So, for example, for the 2008 Farm Bill, we took away the Farm Bill took away direct crop payments. So you weren't getting paid based on what kind of crop you were growing and that kind of thing. But we replaced it with a crop insurance that makes sure that farmers are getting paid a certain amount every year based on either their income in the past or crop prices that are set sometime during the year. And so this crop insurance program was supposed to save us a lot of money, but in actual fact, it seems like it's going to actually end up costing us billions more. Trying to make sure the Farm Bill is aligned with farmer interests and the environment, but so far some of the changes that we've made have had unintended consequences.
Buffer zones have become an interesting and important thing in development generally, including in farming. And you just wrote something recently on that, I think. Can you tell us about buffer zones and what are they and why we need them and what's going on with them?
You know, Minnesota is actually leading the way in putting buffers on farms. And so farming in the U.S. is very fertilizer intensive. And because farmers are often paid, you know, based on how much they grow, they're incentivized to grow as much as they can. And so a lot of farmers have just been growing fence row to fence row, essentially. And buffer zones are grasses or trees that are planted between the field and any kind of waterway that your farm might be bumping up against. Some organic farmers have buffers between their farm and conventional farms because they don't want pesticides and other chemicals to drift onto their land. And so Minnesota passed a law that requires a certain amount of space between farms and what they call riparian areas. That's areas where, you know, rivers, lakes, that kind of stuff. These can really filter out the fertilizers that farmers are applying on their land. So one Iowa State University paper recently found that planting just 10% of your cornfield with prairie could reduce soil and sediment runoff by 95% and could reduce nitrogen and phosphorus fertilizers by about the same amount too. So that's just one of the examples of how very low cost buffers could reduce the environmental impacts of agriculture.
And they have that effect because the roots run much deeper than, say, crop roots and so forth, and so they can, the roots of prairie grasses and so forth, they can absorb those things before they actually get into the water, correct?
Yeah, that's right. So prairie grasses especially have very deep roots, and they stabilize the soil. And they also, you know, like any other plant, they need nitrogen and phosphorus and potassium to grow. If you plant them on the edge of your field, they'll kind of soak up some of those chemicals running off of your field. And the Iowa State University study also found that it'll also reduce the amount of water that's running off of your field. So it actually, it's not only do buffers have environmental benefits, they also have benefits to farmers because more of the fertilizer stays on their field and more water stays on their field. So it's really a win-win.
Are farmers generally on board with the application of policy based on the best science that's available, or is it a case where farmers often believe something to be true that is in conflict with what the science tells us, and they have to be convinced, or because there are powerful political lobbies and voters, the regulations have to be adapted to do something that is not really ideal in order to keep people happy? I'm thinking of a parallel. I don't really know if farmers think this way, but I'm thinking of a parallel in conservation in Minnesota, because you mentioned Minnesota, fishing. I've talked to fishing guides, professional fishermen, resort owners, all the people who are involved in whether or not the fishing is any good in the lakes. And I've talked to the conservation scientists who are in charge of the some of this, and I know a bit about the fish biology, and there's a huge disconnect between what the people who are exploiting the fish and living off the fish believe to be true and what science seems to tell us. Often the science is more ambiguous and doesn't know as much, whereas the fishermen know exactly what's going on, they claim, but they're basically not right most of the time. But the state conservation department has to cater to their unscientific and incorrect beliefs because they're a political force, and you end up with a mishmash of policy that doesn't make sense and ends up not being very effective. Does that kind of thing happen with farming in the U.S.?
There's a lot going on, and one of the things is that I think over or around half of Iowa land is rented. And so what that means is the person that owns it isn't always farming it. And so the incentives are all backwards. If you're just renting a piece of land, there's no incentive for you to make sure the soil is not running off into the water, you know, or that you're protecting the environment because you don't own that piece of land, and maybe you're only going to be farming that piece of land for 5 years. And so, you know, I think that's part of it, is that farming has become very decentralized. A lot of people own a lot of land, but they don't farm it. I think that's one thing. But I also think, you know, as I was mentioning before, that just a lot of the federal farm subsidies incentivize lots of yield and lots of planting in various places. And what we should be doing is incentivizing more conservation and making sure that people that get farm subsidies are doing the bare minimum to ensure that nitrates and other harmful chemicals aren't ending up in people's drinking water. You know, if the public is going to be subsidizing farming, well, you know, we need to ensure that it's not threatening public health.
Let's step aside slightly from food production, because I know something that you've spoken about a lot, written about a lot, are biofuels. Biofuels are in the category of clean energy. It's a way of getting energy, heat, or electricity if you burn it, or some liquid that you can run in a vehicle without using coal or natural gas or some other fossil fuel. So it counts in the clean energy category. And one thing I've noticed is that in the clean energy area, you often find people glom on to a particular solution, solar or wind or biofuels or nuclear. I'll include nuclear in this. And everything else sucks to them. Everything else is bad. I actually had a long debate with someone who's in charge of a biofuel organization who claimed that recycled biodiesel could meet all of our transportation needs, 100%. And that claim required, however, that everyone stop driving. Everyone. Stop driving. So biofuels is one of those areas where people fight, and people are very much against biofuels, or people are very much for biofuels. I think the situation is actually way more complex than one that would allow that kind of dogmatic position taking in that area. Can you give us basically a rundown of, you know, what are the biofuels, what's our current situation roughly with their use, and what's good and bad about them?
Unfortunately, scientists believe that it's been settled and that food-based biofuels are not the way to go. And so when scientists figure it out and they publish peer-reviewed papers, they're kind of like, you know, they dust off their hands and they say, okay, we're done here. You know, lobbying groups are still going to be out there, and they spend lots of money spouting lots of very convincing but not very informed talking points on how biofuels are great for the environment. But so as far as the history goes, a biofuel is basically any type of fuel that is made from organic material like crops, woody biomass, or theoretically out of algae. In the United States, something like 99% of the biofuels that we produce and use every time we go fill up our gas tanks is corn ethanol. So about 40% of the corn that we use, or of the corn that we grow in the United States, is used to make corn ethanol. And, you know, back in 2005 and 2006, the scientists, including from my alma mater, University of Minnesota, thought that corn ethanol would be good for the climate, that if you grow corn, it takes carbon out of the atmosphere, and burning that corn, you know, it's carbon neutral, and it'll be great for the climate. But what they didn't realize, what they cautioned might happen, is if you're using so much corn for fuel, the price of things like animal feed and, you know, corn and soy will go up, and farmers will respond to that by plowing up more grasslands and wetlands and maybe forests in South America to grow more of that stuff, because that's how the market works. Something's expensive, that demand often gets met if there's possible, you know, possibility to do so. Farmers plowed up lots of grasslands and wetlands in the United States. And when we do that, we emit a lot of soil carbon into the atmosphere. And so when you account for what scientists call these land use change emissions, actually corn ethanol is worse for the climate than gasoline. And in 2008, several papers came out saying that essentially when you account for land use change, these food-based biofuels are likely to be worse for the climate than gasoline. The folks who are heavily invested in corn ethanol being a major part of our fuel system keep saying that it's good for the climate and it's good for the environment. But, you know, if you know anything about corn production, it uses more fertilizer and water in this country than any other crop. And it requires a lot more fertilizer than soybeans, for example, and a lot more fertilizer than most other crops. So, you know, it's growing more corn is bad for water then, because if you're applying lots of fertilizer to the land, that runs off into your water. And believe it or not, you have to pay for some of that, because the EPA sets a limit for how much nitrates can be in your drinking water, because it's bad for your health. If babies were to be exposed to drinking water above the EPA limit, they can get what's called blue baby syndrome, which basically cuts off the oxygen supply to their brain. So EPA set this safe limit for nitrates in drinking water, which means that we clean up drinking water so that that doesn't happen. But it's, you know, it's basically taxpayers are footing the bill for a lot of farm pollution in this case. So this Energy Independence and Security Act and the Renewable Fuel Standard, which is another name for it, really intended to make biofuels that are good for the climate, but actually it just incentivizes more corn ethanol, which is bad not just for the climate, but also the environment too.
Okay, but if you were in charge and could just tell everyone what to do, never mind the free market, just shut down the free market. Nobody can buy or sell any biofuel unless Emily says so. Is there a role for it somewhere? And, you know, what would it be that we would produce and what will we use it for? Or is it something we should just walk away from completely?
There is a role, and I think that because while I'd love for the entire grid to be electrified by solar and wind and other very climate-friendly energy sources, we do need to think about how are we going to get there from here. And I think for transportation, for example, my ideal would be that we electrify transportation and the energy supplied for transportation came from renewable sources. But that's going to take a while to do, and especially vehicles like airplanes, it's going to be a long time until we figure out how to get those off of liquid fuels. So I do think for vehicles like airplanes, biofuels are a good thing, but they have to be made from the right stuff. If you're taking down forests in Indonesia and Malaysia to grow palm for biofuel, I would say that's almost probably the worst kind of biofuel you can make. And we actually import some palm biodiesel into the United States, which is just ridiculous. But, you know, we can make biofuels out of waste. You know, as you were saying before, you can get some, like, leftover waste grease from restaurants and turn that into a biodiesel. You know, a lot of scientists are investing a lot of money trying to get algae to turn into a biofuel, which all seem very promising, but they're very expensive right now. And even making cellulosic biofuels, so that's like biofuels from prairie grasses or woody feedstocks, the enzymes to turn the biomass into a fuel are like 20 times more expensive than the enzymes used in corn ethanol. And so a lot of cellulosic ethanol plants have started up and gone bankrupt, or they're trying to produce cellulosic fuels, but they mostly it's from corn stover right now. There's a small amount. So I would say there's a very limited role for biofuels, and it's mostly if you can turn trash into fuel is really the best way to do it until we really lower the cost out of, you know, making, and we figure out how to make fuel out of algae, for example. But if I had to decide right now, costs aside, what kind of biofuel I would like to see was if we grew switchgrass as buffer strips on farms, going back to the buffers, and then we harvested those to make cellulosic ethanol. I think that would be a great way to incentivize farmers to have buffers if we give some economic incentives. And, I think that is kind of a win-win in that you're reducing water pollution, which is the opposite of corn ethanol, which just intensifies water pollution. And you're making sure that the farmer is incentivized economically by, you know, paying them for the feedstock.
Yeah, that's a good idea. I like to think about it a little bit like how nature has designed cellular functioning. I really don't think that it's true that evolution has optimized everything in nature in a way that we would benefit from. Evolution has a lot of things going against it as far as optimizing things. It doesn't get to redesign as much as we can, but there are lessons to learn. And the way that we produce things in our economy and in our society is we maximize the production and externalize the cost as much as possible. So you end up with something that looks like you're getting 10 times the return, but really you're getting 1% of the return. Someone else is paying the 89% difference. Okay, that's what fossil fuels do for us. Imagine, for example, that all of the grasses that are not just buffer zones, but all of them, your lawn, the golf course, the grasses that we keep short next to roads for various reasons, all of it was cut by machines that ran off of biofuel made from the grass. So all you do is invent a system that takes care of itself. We never spend any energy cutting grass because the grass cutting makes the energy we use. But just like in a cell, there's processes like that in nature or in an organism. There's about a 3% extra amount leaks out of the system, and it goes into our general fuel supply. Maybe it's even 10%. Maybe somebody comes along with an invention that helps it get up to 35%, and they get rich. Okay, but if you start off with just, let's just cover our own costs, not externalize anything, and truly match the input and the output for a system that's kind of universal around the entire country, as people are cutting grasses and on a regular basis and a normal for cosmetic reasons, for buffer zone reasons, and so on, and just have something like that just produce its own energy supply plus whatever extra we can get out of it. You know, I think we should be thinking in those sorts of terms. And that, the problem with something like that is it's never going to develop organically from a free market system.
Most fuel sources, including oil, are heavily subsidized. So to say there's even such a thing as a free market system is kind of funny to me, because, it's just we have so many different policies incentivizing different things. You know, to sort of say that we should let biofuels be on the free market, I would agree with that if it weren't for the fact that, you know, gasoline is not on the free market either. So.
Right. And actually, for me, using the word free market is sort of a euphemism for the perceived free market that is a completely made-up concept that never actually happens. Because even if you get rid of its subsidies, you still don't have a free market. Because in order to have a truly free market that operates as economists have modeled, you have to have ideal free actors at every stage, meaning consumers know as much as producers. Consumers have the same level of access and power as producers, and they themselves can be producers and producers can be consumers. That's how the economic models operate. That's what's required. And that never happens. There's never ever been a system organically developed ever that does that. So there's never been a free market, and there never can be a free market.
I looked up whether coal is cheaper than natural gas, for example. It seems I didn't get an answer to my question, unfortunately, but I knew that what I did find is that a lot of coal plants are going out of business because it's very expensive to comply with the environmental regulations. And so this is a way that we've intervened, not by like subsidizing or taxing, but by saying you must meet these standards. And because we've set these standards, we now consume more natural gas than coal, which happens to have a climate benefit, although, you know, natural gas has other problems associated with it. I think that we should use policy and economics to incentivize environmentally friendly fuels. But, you know, in the case of the renewable fuel standard, we thought we were doing that, but we got it really wrong, unfortunately.
The way coal works, of course, is there's these big mines. There's these giant railroad systems that are designed to ship it around, and these very expensive to build coal burning plants. And you can't, if you reduce the use of coal, a mine shuts down. Suddenly, despite, you might now come back later wanting more coal, and so the price should drop because demand, or the price should go up because of that, because demand is going up, and then they should just build more mines, but they can't. Because you can't just start a coal mine. So, in other words, something like coal production comes in such giant chunks that there's no flexibility in the system at all. And what will happen eventually in the next few years is coal will simply become an unavailable resource. It'll be something we won't be mining enough of it because there's not anyone using it, that it will become unavailable, and then we'll have a crisis in the pharmaceutical industry because they need it. It'll be nice when we have the crisis becomes that the pharmaceutical industry is using so much fossil fuel compared to any other use.
Right.
Well, I have a question about fertilizer. You mentioned this has come up several times. So corn uses a lot of fertilizer, and therefore it pollutes more because the fertilizer goes into runoff. Okay. So I have two questions. First, what about the cost of getting the fertilizer is one question. There's basically three kinds of fertilizer mainly, and they come from very different sources, and some of them are hard to get. And then why don't we just put the fertilizer on the fields that the plants need? Why is there fertilizer runoff? Why is any fertilizer running off into the groundwater or into streams when it's something you buy and throw in your fields? Why can't we just put less on the fields?
It's almost cliche to say that agriculture is mechanized, but it's very true. There are some ways in which farmers apply fertilizers at exactly the wrong time, like when there's snow still on the field or something like that. A lot of it is about timing. When do you apply it onto the field? If you're applying it, you know, exactly when it's needed at various parts of your field, then you're going to have a lot less running off because the plants are going to use a lot of it. But I think on average, about half of the fertilizer that we apply on farms runs off into water or becomes nitrous oxide, which is a greenhouse gas that's 300 times more potent than carbon dioxide. It's the rate, but also the timing in which you put down different fertilizers are very important. The three different kinds of fertilizers are those that are made out of nitrogen or ammonia, phosphorus, and also potassium or potash, as they call it. There's a really interesting story behind the making of synthetic fertilizers. It was in the early 20th century, a chemist named Fritz Haber figured out a way to make ammonia fertilizers out of the nitrogen that we have in the air, because as you know, like, what is it, 70% of the air we breathe is N2, it's gaseous nitrogen. So we figured out a way to get the nitrogen from the air and make it into fertilizer, which is great because before we were just using manure and guano, and I think maybe even human waste. So we're no longer dependent on poo, and we could get nitrogen out of the atmosphere and turn it into fertilizer. And this guy, Fritz Haber, he got a Nobel Prize in chemistry in 1918 for this, but he also was known as the father of chemical warfare. And so he was also involved in making chlorine gas. He had a really troubled association with this, especially because his ancestry was Prussian. His ancestry was Jewish, although he converted to Christianity. And he was still in Germany when World War II broke out. And I think a lot of his family had to flee Germany. But his lab was also associated with making the gas Zyklon B, which was used in the concentration camps, the gas chambers. And so some people think that his ancestors might have actually been killed by the gas that he helped create, which is crazy. It's a crazy story. And his wife, actually, his first wife, was also a PhD chemist, and she ended up killing herself because she was a pacifist and she didn't like the idea of using these terrible gases in warfare. So it's a crazy story of an interesting scientist. But also phosphorus, it has an interesting story too, because you know, there's a lot of phosphorus mining around the world. I think like 90% of phosphorus comes from Morocco, China, the U.S., and I'm probably forgetting one other country. But it's estimated that we have about 300 or 400 years worth of phosphorus reserves. People just mine it. It's a mineral that's mined. But we could also use our phosphorus more wisely if we, you know, recycled human waste and had a better system of spreading around animal waste too. So there's lots of potential to improve our, you know, the way that we use nutrients and spread them around the landscape.
There's interesting stories also about both phosphorus and potassium in South Africa. A lot of the important fossil finds are originally discovered because there was a heavy-duty mining industry there for mining out fertilizer from whatever sources were available, and many of those sources ended up being the caves that the Australopithecine fossils are found in. And also, the really gruesome story, because you can use bones as a source of fertilizer. And so animal bones can be calcined and crunched up and thrown onto a field, and you can buy bone meal to add to your garden, right? You can buy it at the gardening store. It's one of the ways of getting fertilizer naturally in your soil. But when the massacre at Macapan occurred, Macapan is a cave sitting on top of Cave of Hearths. Cave of Hearths is one of the longest sequences, archaeological sequences in the world. It's one of the three or four really long 150,000-year sequences plus. And Macapan's cave is a cave on top of that mountain in which Macapan's people hid when they were surrounded by the British during the Zulu Wars and starved to death, basically. They all just died of starvation and thirst in place. And a few years later, the local farmers took out all the skeletons and used them for fertilizer. So the world of fertilizer is full of gruesome and interesting stories, I'll bet. So, but it seems to me, though, that there should be ways to make it so that we put fertilizer on our fields, like you said, you know, more efficiently and just use something much closer to what we really need rather than just throwing it out there at the wrong time or, you know, I don't know, how do we get farmers to do that? I guess we learn how to do it and teach people how to do it. Maybe people should be paying for their runoff. Maybe there should be sensors in groundwater systems that simply a farmer gets a bill for the runoff that they, so you can buy the fertilizer twice. So you buy it once to use it and then you buy it again when it leaves your farm, and you can have the option of maybe not doing that second payment.
Des Moines Water Works is a water utility in Des Moines, Iowa, and they are suing upstream Iowa counties for the fact that they have to spend millions of dollars cleaning up nitrates and other farm pollutants. And so, you know, I think that, and actually I think our Secretary of Agriculture, Bill Sack, recently said that Iowa needs to get its stuff together, because if they don't do something about all of the nitrates and phosphorus running off into waterways and into the Mississippi, like, there's going to have to be some major policy changes. And, you know, one of the things that the Environmental Working Group advocates is that, you know, if you're getting federal farm subsidies, there should be what we call a basic standard of care. So that is that, you know, you don't apply fertilizer when, you know, the ground is still covered in snow and ice and it's likely to run off. And we have a few other standards, like a minimum buffer zone between you and any waterway. And so it's just a way that we can ensure that, you know, farming practices aren't bad for the environment and public health.
Which we keep coming back to water. You're talking about how much water is used to make ethanol or just to grow corn, and water being polluted by fertilizing and over-fertilizing and so on. You know, the history of civilization is closely linked to this. There's theories that suggest that early civilization emerged in many cases because of the problem of riparian rights, where You know, you have a stream that only runs for a week out of every year, if you're lucky, and you can capture some of it and use it to fertilize it, to water your gardens. But if the guy upstream builds a big dam and keeps all the water, then you have to settle that dispute somehow. And so in a system where there's no government, you don't have a way of doing it. So what you do is you get together and invent government. You invent an overarching system that takes care of these problems, takes care of these disputes, and that's the beginning of civilization in, you know, one part of the world or another. It seems like making this into a riparian right issue does give the government a lot of power, because it already does have a lot of power. We regulate, in our country, every body of water that you can float a two-foot-long stick in is under the auspices of the Army Corps of Engineers, and it's pretty much regulated by the government in that way. So it's we have entire departments of water in every state. It seems like the water approach is a good way of, because everything ends up in the water or coming out of the water or requiring water. Everything somehow links to water. It's like, this new planet that was discovered is completely bogus if it doesn't have water on it. You know, it's like, really great news if there's water. Otherwise, so what? You know, it's just another, you know, dry, dead planet.
Right. And what people don't realize about agriculture, and one of the reasons why I even study farming in general, is that it's largely exempt from so many environmental regulations. I mean, the Clean Air Act or Clean Water Act, most farms don't have to comply or even think about these regulations because they're considered a non-point source. They're not like a big factory that we would consider a point source. They're considered a non-point source, so they don't have to disclose often if their farming methods result in lots of pollutants getting into the water. This is frustrating because we have these regulations for a reason, and it's not just environmental. It's so that we can have clean air and clean water for people to drink. So
the E. coli variations that infect and make people sick really emanate from a lot of times from dairy farms and so forth, that the vegetable farms and so forth, their water is coming from a source that's near dairy, and that's caused a lot of people to get sick just directly.
A lot of antibiotic-resistant bacteria comes out of farming systems because we use something like 80% of our antibiotics on livestock production systems, and as well as like medically important antibiotics, like, you know, the same antibiotics that a doctor would give you if you were suffering from major infection, which is really bad because then if you use those antibiotics a lot, then the bacteria evolve, as everything does, and it becomes resistant to those medicines.
Which also brings up the topic now of meat. Cutting the use of meat by half would give us more room or more years of agriculture or less demand for fertilizer or less fertilizer runoff or, yes, less demand for water. Just everything, all of our problems would kind of not go away, but they'd back off for several decades if we just cut our meat in half. Isn't that true?
There's a lot of different environmental problems with meat. I don't think a lot of people know that. It's like 10 times as much resources to produce meat than plants. Certainly, as soon as I figured that out, that was kind of a life-changing realization for me. To be honest, my freshman year of college, before I got into environmental science, I didn't even know that meat had a big environmental footprint. And once I did, it kind of changed the way I thought about my diet. But, you know, and I would hope that when people learn that meat production is very environmentally expensive, they do it too. But I think the main message should be, you know, it doesn't take going vegan to reduce your environmental impact. It's very small changes like reducing beef consumption, few meatless days, you know, considering meat as like a condiment rather than the main focus of the meal. You know, there are lots of ways to reduce meat consumption that don't result in boring tofu sandwiches.
And you have talked in the past about the virtue of the chicken.
I think the chicken versus beef thing is an interesting example of whether or not something is better for the environment than something else depends on what you care about the most. So beef is incredibly carbon intensive. It's about 4 times as carbon intensive as chicken. It's at least 4 times. Pork has about half to a third the carbon footprint that beef has. And plants are like about 10 times less than that. Eating a chicken sandwich instead of a quarter pounder is much better for the climate. But if you live on the East Coast you might be aware of the terrible pollution that happened in the Chesapeake Bay, mostly due to big concentrated animal feeding operations dumping their manure, you know, leaking into waterways, and that causing big water quality and environmental problems in the Chesapeake Bay. That is to say that eating a chicken sandwich can have bad water quality impacts, whereas eating a beef burger has terrible climate impacts and probably water quality impacts too. It depends on these metrics can kind of get a little bit confusing sometimes, like a paper bag versus a plastic bag, for example, because it takes less carbon intensive to make a plastic bag. But everyone, no one wants to use plastic because they've seen those videos of plastic in the oceans, you know, but, you know, paper bags break down in the landfill, but they're much more carbon intensive. So what is better for the climate or better for the environment depends on what you care about in that instance. But, you know, I do think from my standpoint, climate is a very important thing to think about, especially when beef production is responsible for so much methane emissions, and methane is once again a very powerful greenhouse gas that is like 30 times more potent to the climate than carbon dioxide. EWG did a recent look at concentrated animal feeding operations in manure pits in North Carolina, and we estimate the amount of manure that's produced and stored in North Carolina is way, way more than could be spread on fields locally. Not to mention the fact that people in North Carolina communities, I'm sure you've seen there's been a few exposés in Civil Eats, for example. They've looked at how farmers in the air spray manure into the air with these, like, you know, big hoses, and the manure just, like, you know, drips into people's yards and on their clotheslines, and just, like, you know, they smell it in their homes, and it's really bad. I think that just goes to show, like, the way that we're very concentrated and mechanized, and we only produce one thing in one area, is really, you know, has these bad environmental impacts of, well, now we have so much manure, which would usually be a good thing because we need manure for fertilizers, but we have too much in one place and it's very expensive to ship it to another place, and so we're just going to try to spread it as much as we can in the place where the CAFOs are. But really what needs to happen is we need to, you know, change the way we're producing animals in the first place and produce less of them and spread them out across the landscape so that they're not in confined operations where their manure has to be concentrated in these terrible lagoons.
How much food do we waste, and where is that waste concentrated?
The United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, I think, estimates about a third to 40% of our food is wasted. In the United States, that's mostly waste that happens at homes and in restaurants. You know, people often think, well, it's happening at the fields. It's, you know, when I'm driving down the California coast, sometimes you'll see, like, big tomato trucks, and their tomatoes will be spilling out of the truck. But actually, most of the food waste doesn't happen there, although great to increase, you know, improve efficiencies there and waste less food, but it just happens at the home. And since we pay so little for our food in this country, we don't often think about throwing it away as much. But in the developing world, unfortunately, it happens a lot with at the production and storage scale. So a lot of places in Africa, they don't have the proper storage facilities for grains. Bugs will get into their grain storage facilities and decimate it, and they can't sell it on the market right when they've harvested it. And so in other countries, it's more complicated than just people throwing it in the trash.
Yeah, I'm really fascinated by that dichotomy because, you know, I've lived for extended periods of time in a situation where you're not allowed to waste any food at all. When I was in the Congo, we had to going to the grocery store involved a 500-kilometer drive over roads that would break the car to the tune usually of about a $500 repair job, and it would take 10 days. So the difficulty in getting food was so great and it would take away from research time to have to do it more often, that we didn't waste food. We were as good as you could be about not wasting food. If an insect infestation happened in our beans, we got to eat beans with insects in them. You know, that's all. We did not waste a drop of food. Meanwhile, as you say, the farmers there would lose a lot of food to either to one thing or another, sometimes on the ground to locusts or simply because it couldn't be stored properly. Root crops are really lousy to store. They don't store well. They store okay in the ground for a while. And so there's this idea of a third of the food being wasted in the higher productivity, more intensive cash farming in the third world, and a third of the food being wasted in your kitchen in the United States. But if you go to those third world countries and go to the homes and look at what people are doing with their food there, they're not wasting a drop of it. You know, people in outside the United States don't waste their food at all. So we need, it needs to be, it's actually an interesting challenge. It needs to be something that we culturally embrace, you know, not wasting our food.
Part of the problem is, too, is that the dating systems that they have on a lot of our produce and our meat and all that kind of stuff, that's not really necessarily based on scientific studies that estimate how long food can last. And so we end up throwing out food that's perfectly good prematurely just because it, you know, expiration date says, you know, dump it. And there's been a lot of work that's been done on trying to publicize that problem.
Absolutely. And people make the mistake of seeing a date and thinking they should throw the food out, when it's often a sell-by date. And a sell-by date on a can of beans means you've got, you know, 2 more years. I mean, you've probably got a lot more than that.
Yeah, especially with dairy. Dairy is one of those things where it'll tell you if it's bad because it smells.
Right.
So whenever I'm, like, looking at my yogurt or milk or something and it's past the expiration date, you really have to smell it. With cheese too, just because part of it is moldy doesn't mean the whole thing is moldy. So, you know, you gotta cut that part off. But I think a lot of people find that disgusting and don't want to do it, but it's actually like, it's not often dangerous to do that, to make sure you're not eating something moldy and knowing when something is still fine to eat.
The most commonly read blog post on my blog is the one with the title, What Happens If I Eat Mold? And it's the one with also the second or third most comments. I get a comment every several a week on that post. And
what does happen if you eat mold?
What I say in the post is really nothing. It's like, for the most part, just scrape the mold off. If you ate something with mold on it and later realize it, don't worry. if something makes you feel sick, you know, call your doctor. But for the most part, it's nothing. It means nothing. Mold, for the most part, is just trying to trick you into not wanting to eat it, okay? And cheese, for example, is already milk that has been transformed by microbial activity. So a little more microbial activity might actually make it into better cheese, for all that goes. And by the way, if your milk smells a bit off, microwave it. Just a little. Just not even to heat it up. Just a little microwave. And then smell it again, and the smell will be gone. And if the smell's not gone, maybe it's not working. But usually, that works if you
Never
have a microwave.
Done that.
Yeah, it works great. My friend Barbara Isaac taught me that. Barbara Isaac never in her entire life ever threw out a piece of food. Again, someone who grew up in the field and, you know, never always had the 500-kilometer minimum drive to the grocery store. You just learn to not do this stuff. And of course, there's no microwave. You'd have to in the middle of the field. You would use a different technique than a microwave to heat it up, but just heat the milk up a bit and that smell will go away and it'll be good for several more days. What is your take on regulating GMOs?
I think the history of GMOs in the United States is really interesting. We, for the most part, a majority of GMOs in this country are herbicide tolerant. So they're engineered to resist whatever herbicide the company wants to spray on it, or it has a bacterial protein called BT, which if insects eat it, it's toxic to them. That has allowed us to use less insecticides in this country. But there's actually a new wave of GMOs, kind of a second generation of GMOs that are engineered to withstand multiple kinds of herbicides. So they're like the first generation of herbicide-tolerant GMOs in that they're engineered to withstand. The biggest used one in the United States is called Roundup. You may notice that a lot of homes use it in their backyards to kill weeds. these crops are called Roundup Ready because you can spray a lot of Roundup, or the chemical in there is called glyphosate on them. But these new GMOs are engineered to withstand not just Roundup, but also dicamba and 2,4-D. Well, the crops that are engineered to withstand glyphosate or Roundup and dicamba are called Roundup Ready to Extend. They're made by Monsanto, and they were approved for sale by the USDA, but the EPA hasn't approved the herbicide that goes along with the seeds. And so it's actually illegal for farmers to spray dicamba and glyphosate on these new GMOs this year during the growing season, but farmers are doing it anyway. And that's actually caused a lot of crop damage in the Midwest, especially southern Midwest, places like Arkansas and Missouri. Lots of farmers are complaining. There's been over 100 complaints by farmers that their crops are being damaged because dicamba drifts easily into other people's farms, to neighboring farms, and it damages their crops if those crops aren't genetically engineered. And so some farmers are feeling like they have to choose between adopting these new GMOs or having their crop destroyed. So I think this is an example of the fact that we're just engineering new GMOs to be resistant to different chemical cocktails, which basically, you know, demonstrates that we're on this chemical treadmill, that once one chemical, in this case Roundup, stops working, we start to change to different combinations of chemicals in order to fight the weeds that farmers are battling. And it also shows that our pesticides regulations in this country are really lacking, especially if we want to protect crops on other fields, and also farmer health too. If pesticides are drifting onto other farms, we should understand how it's affecting farmer health and wildlife too. So I think, you know, we're kind of a little bit in the wild west of regulation, in a sense, in that new GMOs are being introduced resistant to new combinations of herbicides, and we're kind of trying to regulate them, but often we're kind of shoot first, ask questions later. We don't operate under the precautionary principle of well, what if these new GMOs have unintended consequences? We just kind of say, well, you know, in this case, farmers want it because super weeds are hurting their yields, and Monsanto has made this new seed, and so let's approve the seed and the herbicide. But I think, you know, there's so much more we need to know about the wildlife and human health impacts of widespread GMO adoption, that I wish we'd take it slower and do a better analysis of these impacts. Last year, the Obama administration withdrew their approval of a new herbicide, which is a combination of Roundup again and 2,4-D, Enlist Duo. And they found Dow apparently didn't reveal documents that showed that it had synergistic toxicity, the combination of these two herbicides. So it means that in combination, these herbicides are more toxic than they are apart. And they're more likely to drift onto other people's fields. And so we're trying to figure out, you know, the impacts of these chemical cocktails on wildlife and human health. And, you know, oftentimes we don't even have the right information to make these decisions. Either the company hasn't done the studies, or the only studies are by the company, and because it's proprietary. And, you know, I'm not anti-technology, but I think that we need to really understand how new crops that are going to take up so much of our land area are going to affect our health and wildlife.
Where did the farmers get this herbicide if it's not approved yet?
Dicamba is an older herbicide. It's probably been around since the 50s. It's not a new herbicide. It's used on corn sometimes, but it's really harmful to soybeans, which is why they shouldn't be spraying it on soybeans. So it's been around. It's very drift prone, which is why the EPA hasn't approved it for widespread use yet, and it has a lot of restrictions on it that you can't spray it during certain periods of time, that if you're going to spray it, it's got to be at least a certain distance from a neighboring field. So all of this is part of pesticide regulations that are managed by the EPA, and it basically requires that you read the label of a pesticide bottle before you spray it. But a recent survey said I think over half of farmers unfortunately do not read the label before spraying it. So
it's a good argument for more. I mean, it's not an argument against GMOs inherently as being a technology of use, but it is an argument for keeping better control over what ends up happening with GMOs when they are deployed.
Well, yeah, and I think someone who blogs on agriculture, Don Carr, said it best when he said, if the first GMO was like a peanut that prevented allergic reactions, everyone would love GMOs,
right.
You know? But the fact of the matter is that the GMOs that we have right now are engineered to, by and large, are engineered to withstand herbicides, and this has caused more herbicide-resistant weeds that are really troublesome for farmers, and it's led to more herbicide use on farms and switching back to these older herbicides like dicamba and 2,4-D that potentially could have some big impact on health and environment. So no, I mean, I'd love to see some GMOs that create benefits, but so far they haven't, unfortunately.
Thank you, Emily Cassidy, for a great interview and discussion on environmental impacts and choices we make in producing and consuming our food. Thank you, listeners, for your continued interest and your enthusiasm in sharing Iconocast with your friends. Greg Layden and I, Mike Harbrick, are excited about bringing even more science to you. Watch soon for another episode of Iconocast.